I'm Georgie Crawford. You're listening to the Good Glow podcast. Throughout my treatment for breast cancer, I've realised the importance of self-care. Whether it's a trip to the gym, a checkup with your GP, or even a 5-minute meditation, the time has come for us to put ourselves higher on our own to-do list. I'm so proud to be teaming up with Fitbit again in 2020. I want to continue on my path of self-discovery and set myself new challenges this year. Often it's only when we're tested that we're awakened to our true potential. I recently completed a 12K run in the Swiss Alps, something I never thought I could do. But with Fitbit by my side, I'm able to stay focused on my health fitness journey, continue to be motivated to go after my goals and to track my progress too. And with that, I'm surprising myself every single day. This week on the Good Glow podcast, I speak to Pamela Laird. Pamela started working in the beauty industry when she was just a kid. She set up her own nail bar by the time she was leaving school, and since then has gone on to build her brand, Moxie Loves. She suffered a major knockback when her hero product had to be discontinued under EU law, but she picked herself up and continued on and won a place on 2019's UK Apprentice. With an audience of 10 million tuning in every night, Pamela took on her biggest challenge yet. Today, she speaks to me about what goes on behind the scenes of the show, how she stays resilient, and what advice she has to young girls who want to start their own business. Pamela Laird, welcome to the Good Glow podcast.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited.
It was so nice to meet you in real life because I've been watching you on The Apprentice over the last couple of months and I just thought you came across so well on it. So congratulations. Third place.
Thank you.
That is huge.
Oh, it's completely surreal. I honestly didn't think I'd get past the first week, and to have made it that far with, you know, such competition involved and even in the UK as the only Irish on it. Yeah, it really felt like a massive achievement.
I'm so excited. I'm going to absolutely grill you on everything to do with it in a couple of minutes. But I want to talk about first, like, you're 30 years old. You've got a successful business. I mean, it's the dream for most women out there to have what you have right now. So tell me a little bit about growing up. Obviously, your mum was in the beauty industry and you learned from her from a very young age.
Yeah, so both my parents actually were entrepreneurs. So my dad actually had a car garage in the city centre. My mum had a beauty salon. And so it really was just normal to either go to one or the other after school because they both worked for themselves. So sometimes I would get put in the garage in the cars and that was just not fun at all. So I'd always hope to get to go to the salon. And I'd go and I just loved being there, loved being with my mom, loved seeing all the products and the glamour and get my nails done. You know, it was really just the place for me and I loved beauty. And so I think that definitely was a destiny to be in the beauty industry purely because of my mom. And I think probably because she worked for herself, it was just a natural thing. I always felt like I wanted to work for myself and that was just a path I went through. And I think being there and just seeing how hard she worked, but the reward of working for yourself. And yeah, it just really felt like that's what I wanted to do.
And I suppose it gave you a really realistic view of what it's like to run your business. Like, I know you've spoken before that you would have loved to just do nails all the time because that's your passion. But when you're running a business, you've got the people management and the accounts and all that sort of thing. So when was your first kind of independent step into the beauty industry?
So I worked in my mum's salon and then I really thought I could do nails. Like, nails was definitely something I was good at. I noticed I did all my training when I was in transition year, so I started doing my friend's nails and I definitely felt like I was good at nails. And you kind of like what you're good at, you know, that way it felt like, okay, no, I could do this. So I looked into opening a nail bar. And mum obviously helped me with the discussions because I was 17, I was still in school. But cancelling my French oral exam to go and meet House of Fraser, like, that was what was happening to me in sixth year. So mum let me open a nail bar. So she had a nail brand at the time that she was distributing. So I had the stock from there, set it up, thought, this is it. Like, I love nails. I love working. Perfect. Left school, opened that in 2008. And all was great. We were doing extremely well. And I realized, okay, we can scale up. We can add more services. We add more beauty services, more products. We got more space. And then I turned into a manager. And I wasn't doing nails as much. I was making sure somebody was there. The opening hours, you know, 9 a.m. till 9 p.m, then 10, you know, Dundrum started opening later. And it felt like, God, there's no love here anymore. And actually, I'm stuck. I can't scale this. I'm one person. I'm managing people. I need more people. I don't want more people. I want a different kind of job. And I realized that if I take this any further, my heart isn't in it. So I made a really tough decision to close it after 4 years. With the hope of figuring out what I wanted to do, I thought maybe going into training would be more, but then I realized, no, like I'm not patient enough for that. So I then looked at products and so spent the next 2 years just grafting on building a range.
And this was in your early 20s.
Yeah. So this was, I must have been 22 or 23 when I started working on the products.
And I suppose all of your friends were in college and going on J1s and living their best lives.
Yes.
What was that time like for you?
It was very different for me. And I didn't really drink at the time. I wasn't really going out as much. Like my social life definitely wasn't what probably most, you know, early 20s were. Because I really was so focused. And I think a lot of people were going traveling and really not working. And I never really grasped the not working side. So it took me a few years to get back in with my friends. Once they all returned from their mad trips away for a year, 2 year, Australia, Bali, you know, wherever, Thailand, and then interrailing even, I could kind of relate to them. They were all in their jobs. And now we all, you know, we're all on the same level. But at that stage, it definitely felt like, I don't get it. Like, I don't want to go anywhere. I want to go on holidays for a week, fine, but I want to work. And, you know, my friends are going off and not working for 6 months at a time. And I just could not relate to that at all.
Wow. And so your brand then, Moxie Loves, was born then when you were in your early 20s. And where did the name come from?
Moxie's a name that was really interesting to me. So it's in the dictionary. We had to tweak it slightly for trademark. But Moxie with an E, so M-O-X-I-E, means if you've got a force of or determination or drive, you're said to have Moxie. And that actually came from a soda company in the States that was said to be so highly caffeinated, so full of sugar, that if you could finish it, you had Moxie. So it was a very kind of sassy word. I felt like I could definitely build a range around that. I thought it had scope. It was multilingual. I thought people would understand what it meant. You could say, anybody could say it. So I wanted like a short name that somebody could say and understand. So that's where it came from. And I worked with a designer to do the logo and that. But yeah, it's just a name I instantly connected with.
Yeah, it's definitely a name that you wouldn't forget. And it's easy to say. And then tell us about your first product in that range. Was that your hero product?
It was. And it was really difficult to decide which product to start with because I had so many on the go in development, but I realized I had no cash to like launch them all at once like I dreamed. So it was like, okay, pick one, like one iconic product. And I thought, well, the Liquid Fill Cotton Bud, which is known as the eye catcher in my range, that's got to be it. Like I've seen makeup artists work behind the scenes on photo shoots. I knew it was something that both professionals and the everyday person would love to have in their handbag. And yeah, it took off. We were really lucky at the time when I launched it that social media, people shared everything, you know, it wasn't carefully created pictures like it is now. It was like, oh, someone sent me this and it looks good. I'm going to put it on my Instagram. And that's really what like most of the Irish influencers did and journalists and makeup artists when I sent it out. So it was just instantly massive. We launched into Penny's, Primark, all the stores, Boots, everywhere had it. It was for sure the most iconic product.
So it's basically a cotton bud that, say you were getting your makeup done professionally and a bit of eyeliner or makeup drops off your eye, they would dip the cotton bud into cleanser and then kind
tidy
of correct it. But this was kind of all in one that they didn't have to.
Yeah, it was one step. So each bud is individually wrapped and what's inside the chamber, like the hollow cotton wool bud, is actually eye cleanser. So it had a click to release formula. So you clicked one end and then the other end of the tip would be moist, ready to tidy up your mistake.
Wow. And what was that phone call like from Penny's when they say they want your product?
I mean, it took a few door knocks. I sent in samples, sent in emails, and I think they're so on trend that they would see what was going on social media and they knew that they had to have it. Well, that's what I like to think. When I got it was an email and it was like, yes, but I just like, no, I nearly died when I saw it on shelf. That was because until it's on shelf, nothing's like real, really, you know, it's emails and whatever. But when I saw it on shelf, that was just an insane moment and will forever be. Like, I have photos of me standing next to it like giddy goat. I just, yeah, it's still a pinch me moment.
Because you see all these brands in there, like Suzanne Jackson and, you know, and there's your brand.
I know.
Like side by side, these amazing Irish businesswomen. Like, yeah. It's just incredible. And that day, like, do you remember what you did after you visited the store? Like, did you celebrate?
I don't think I did. And I think that's really hard as an entrepreneur. You don't really stop to celebrate the milestones because there's always another. And it took so long to get that when you're already halfway through the next. And that's probably the difficulty, is that you really don't stop and say, that was actually a big moment. You know, we should celebrate. I didn't really do that, but I did buy one and I still have the receipt.
Oh my God.
So I have that day that I was in there. So obviously I do in my mind mark it as being an epic moment. But yeah, I don't probably stop to celebrate the wins enough.
And there obviously is pressure then when you're, you know, your product is in Primark and then you're like, oh my God, I need to keep this momentum up. Like, what's next? Are you always on?
Yeah, totally. And it is what's next. And sometimes, you know, it's really difficult when you're, you know, when your product's so popular, you think everything's great, but then you're like, oh, scrambling because you need to order more. And you had planned to put all this time into a new product. Here you are focusing on the first product, getting that right, getting it into store, launching into the UK, trying to navigate how to get journalists to talk about it there because I had no contacts there. So that was really tough at that time because everything looked amazing. But of course, you know, it's social media, everything looks great. It wasn't as easy as I thought it would be. And actually, looking back now, I definitely could have handled it a bit better and had a bit more planning. I didn't really plan for the success as such. But you're never off. You're constantly thinking, you're seeing things and trying to think ahead all the time is, yeah, you're never off.
Because you say in interviews, we, but you've said before that it's just you.
Yeah, I naturally drift into we. I think it sounds better. But no, it's just me. I parted ways with an investor last year. So from that point of view, I always said we because I would include in my mind, you know, the backer that I had and the team that he brought. But yeah, it is just me now. You know, we parted ways. And obviously last year was a really busy year. So growing the team is really important part of 2020 because I really can't do it on my own. Like, it's too much. I'm not really sure how I am doing it, but it is just me. Yeah. So the we, just ignore that. It's not we.
Tell us about then the EU ban on single-use plastics. Like, you've said before that you kind of felt like that was coming down the line, like you had a bit of an inkling that it was going that way.
Well, there was a photo that circulated of a seahorse gripping a standard plastic cotton bud and it went viral. An underwater photographer took it. People were up in arms and my magic innovation that was the best thing since sliced bread yesterday became just the devil in plastic, essentially, because it's plastic wrapped in more plastic. And I have to say, I was ignorant to the fact of, you know, where plastic went, what happens to plastic when you put it in your recycling bin, like where does it go? And we had always looked at biodegradable plastic going forward because it was, you know, part of a trendy, you know, I suppose consumers were interested, but this was relatively overnight. My product became just unsellable. People did not want it. And yeah,
literally because of that photo.
Because of that photo. Within 2 weeks of that, the EU Commission released a statement about how they were going to tackle single-use plastics, really based around this photo, very reactive, which is really important, you know, because it did raise a light on an area that a lot of people didn't know. And the main thing was that by 2020, plastic cotton buds would be completely banned in the EU. Scotland had already trialed it very quickly. So it was pretty much overnight that I knew this was going to happen and I had a phase out period. But what I didn't expect was consumer perception to flip as fast as it did. And so the phase out period was pretty much irrelevant because I had to get rid of it. I had to walk away from it because...
For your sake, for your reputation.
My brand, yeah. Because, I mean, people, it's so iconic and I thought I'd have had more products out by then, but because it was so popular, we were focused on it. So yeah, it was a massive mistake to launch one product and be so heavily reliant on it and then for basically the rug to be pulled from under you.
And how did you get through that time? Like, you seem like a really positive person, really focused, always kind of on to the next thing. But was there a time around then that you were just a little bit broken?
Yeah, like I felt like a failure totally. And I felt really exposed because people think oh, this is great. And then it's like, oh, well, now it's not great. What are you going to do? And people are looking at you. You know, my stores were looking at me, like my distributor at the time. It was really hard because I didn't really have an answer. I knew that we were completely restricted by the legislation. We couldn't do biodegradable plastic. That was out. And that was my answer. And I thought, well, I'm going to my manufacturers. And sure, they're in China. It's not banned there. They have no interest in adapting to Europe. You know, to them, it's not big enough. So, and I was too small to command any change. So it felt like the little person's getting squeezed kind of, and there's nothing I can do about it. But I took it as an interesting curve and a pivot. And this is always going to happen in business. You're like, it felt like, oh my God, it's happening to me so soon. I'm not ready for such a massive disaster to happen to my business. But at the same time, it really focused me on, well, what's coming? You know, what is the fine print in that legislation? What can I take as a positive? And in the fine print, face wipes was a massive kind of little asterisks. It was coming in 2025 that they were going to make face wipes all have to be biodegradable. So I was like, well, I'm going to use that. And so I put my thinking cap on. I was working on a product at the time that I thought, well, no, we have to completely change this. We're going to be ahead of this curve this time. We're not going to be left behind. And so I brought out Barefaced, which is a biodegradable cotton pad. It's the cotton fibers are infused with cleanser, so you just add water to them. And what makes wet wipes not biodegradable is that in order to be shelf ready, if you wet a tissue, it just disintegrates. Wet wipes don't. And that's because there's plastic fibers running through the wipe to keep it stable on the shelf and keep it intact. And if you've ever tried to rip a face wipe, it's quite difficult because of those fibers. So I knew that I would be ahead of it and that this wasn't going to happen to me again. So I did take it as a positive in the end. But yeah, I mean, there were days where I was like, what am I going to do? Like, I couldn't think my way out of it. But I think I work well under pressure. I think a lot of people do. And sometimes the best ideas can come out of the worst situations.
Mm. Like sometimes you just have to, the worst thing has to happen in yes. order for you to learn and grow and continue. But you said recently a really interesting statistics about flushing face yes. wipes down the toilets. Yeah. What was that again?
And so many people do, but a face wipe takes 100 years to biodegrade and some will never. And most of them, even at a biodegradable level, because that it's not really clear at how much has to biodegrade to be biodegradable, but they release microplastics into the aquatic system. So little tiny pieces of plastic are floating around the ocean because people are flushing wipes. Also, you've got, I think 97% of blockages in the UK are down to fat packs from people flushing wipes because they don't, like flushing them down the toilet, they stay intact because they're already wet. They're not going to break down. They can't. And so they just compact together and block the sewers. And yeah, it's just not good.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you picked yourself up from that and you kept going. That's amazing. Yeah. Tell us then, you went on to Dragon's Den. We won't talk too much about that because you're probably sick of telling that story about Dragon's Den. But then one of your friends contacted you and sent you the application form for The Apprentice.
Yeah. I have to say, I'd never watched a full series. My mum loved The Apprentice, but I'd watch it and get stressed about how little time they had. Like, that's just not realistic. Mum, why are you watching this? But my friend is a big fan. She sent it to me and was like, Pam, you'd be amazing. And I was like, absolutely not. And I just went on and was like, Lord Sugar's investments. And they were all turning over £1 million a year. Like, one cosmetics brand he invested in turns over £22 million a year. So that really piqued my interest. And I thought, well, I'm quite uncomfortable in a business scenario. I do suffer with the imposter syndrome. I don't have the lingo. I didn't study business. And so I always felt like, God, looking for investment traditionally, you know, the Dragon's Den was amazing because I got to talk about my product. But when it comes down to how you pitch for investment, it's such a different world. And I always felt like that was going to be really difficult for me. Whereas I looked at The Apprentice and thought, well, that's going to show my capabilities. It's going to be a little less formal, which is what I thought. And so I thought, well, sure, let's apply. Like, I need the investment. So why not? What could go wrong?
And when you were applying, did you kind of think in the back of your head you had a feeling that you might get on, or were you like, I have no chance here?
Personally, I felt like it's TV, firstly. So the dynamics of the group of people will come into it. So I thought, well, look, I'm blonde. I own a cosmetics brand. They're not going to have two of me. So if they want a blonde Irish who has a beauty brand, then maybe. But I knew that it would come down to a mixture of things. I definitely didn't go on going, I'm going to step on everyone's toes to get ahead. Like, I wasn't going to go in and do the one-liners that they wanted. So I knew that maybe that would put me at a disadvantage. And I didn't know if my business being successful would be enough to get me through. it was. But, you know, when you see some of the other characters, you know, it's not always about business. Mm-hmm. And so I was lucky enough, I guess, to have that carry me through, because it certainly wasn't my ruthlessness that got me through the auditions, I can tell you that.
And did you have to go to London and sit down in front of a camera and
speak? The auditions were insane. So I got there on the first day and I thought, oh, my time is 12:15. I'll just walk in. I went in and there were thousands of people there. And I was like, oh, my God,
thousands.
And we're queuing up. Anyway, they asked me when I was checking in at this desk, like, it was weird. It was like going on a flight or something. They were like, oh, you're flying home. And they made a note. So I did get ushered through slightly because they knew I had to go. Some people had been there 4 hours already and seen nobody. So it was like the most intense day. You had to line up 30 seconds, tell me about yourself. And then they'd call numbers, move you on. And then I knew I was making it to the next level because they'd put me in the lift up to the next floor, but they wouldn't tell you anything. And then you'd sit down. I was talking to someone and they were like, okay, take her. And you're just like moved through. Then I got to the top floor and that was a piece to camera, which is now my audition tape that's on the website. So watching that back, it was after like 6 hours of auditions that was recorded. So watching it back, it's like, oh my God. And then we went back over again. And this was more of a task type audition and it was like groups. So two of the guys who made it into the show, so Dean and Aisha, were in my second audition. But at the time, like, I walked away from that going, did I get through? Like, how would I know? Like, we both teams lost. Basically, we had to build flat pack furniture. We both lost and you'd half an hour to build it. And so I was like, okay, so how do we know who's going to be put through to the show from this? They obviously just watch the dynamics of you and how you work in a team and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. But yeah, it's mad to think that when I got the phone call to say I had it, I had no clue whether I did or not. There was just no way to measure it whatsoever.
What was that day like when they told you were going on?
So they told me they were going to call me at 2 and tell me either way. So the whole day I was just sitting there like, oh my God. And I didn't know if I'd wanted it, because at that stage it had sent me out the thing saying you'd be away for 10 weeks. You'll have no access to friends, family or your business. No internet, no email, no phone, nothing.
Stop.
So that was a really tough decision because I knew my business would suffer when I was gone because it's just me. But then I had to weigh it up. Well, this could be the best thing that's ever happened to my business at the same time if I do well and I go far. So it was one of those really tough decisions that I had to make. And I think it's once in a lifetime. So when I got the call, I knew I wanted it because he started off the call. So Pamela, we want to thank you. And then it was sort of like, you know, we explained there's a reserve position, like in every TV show. There's people who don't make it on but have to go through the process as if they will. And they only get on if someone backs out. And he said, so I explained the reserve position to you. I'm just going to explain that again. And I was like to my mom, no, I didn't get it. Like, and I felt disappointed. So then when he said, but I want to offer you a place, I knew I wanted it then. Immediately, I was like, okay, any doubt I ever had is gone because of that. And I just was ecstatic. I had like 3 weeks then to pack and go.
Oh my God. And so you were with your mum when you got the phone call. And what was that moment like?
Well, she like leaned, nearly fell over on a box, like crushed a box. It was just so funny. Like, I couldn't write it. So we were both laughing and she's like, I can't believe you're going to be going. And I was like, mum, I could be back in a week. Like, so I really had the mind of, Asher, I'll be back in a week. It'll be fine. Mm. Don't worry. And I had to get vaccinations done. So I was like, okay, I'm going somewhere.
Right.
They didn't tell us where. So mum and I were like trying to plan on like the map, like where do you need these vaccines for? You know, India, China, like where would I, anyway, South Africa, obviously, in the end. But yeah, she was so excited for me. But I'd say she missed me a lot more than she thought, I think.
And did you get help from the show for like wardrobe, makeup, things like that?
No, they told us like what you couldn't wear. So we had to send off our boardroom photos for approval. And I think that was really just for the color dynamics of everybody, so that someone was already had like a blush pink suit, so I couldn't have a blush pink dress, you know, that kind of thing.
So like for 10 weeks, your boardroom.
So you only get 3 options for boardroom.
Okay.
Yeah. So you have to rotate the 3. But right, the other outfits are based on the day. Like sometimes you'd come down in the morning and then the producer would go, okay, no, you have a white blouse. Someone has to change. You know, that's what they, yeah. So there is a lot of that, but they don't control your wardrobe or anything. It's just the boardroom outfits color wise.
So the night before then you were heading off to do this show. Mm. Did you sleep? What was running through your mind?
So I had to go to London the day before, no, 2 days before. So the night before, it was my friend who's moved to London's birthday. So I was like, do you know what? I'm going to go out. I'm going to meet her. So I went out. out.
And could you tell her?
No. So I was out with her and she's like, I can't believe you're not staying. And I was like, I can't. And I was really upset because I was like, I can't tell her and mum isn't here and it's my last day. But it was really fun when I was leaving. Mum was dropping me to the airport and I'd like said, look, let's book you a flight so you can come into the airport and sit with me the whole time. And she's like, no, no, no. Like, imagine I didn't get on the flight. How would I get out of the airport? And I was like, oh yeah, that, I never really thought about that. So she had booked the Platinum Services where you get to sit in a lounge. So I sat with her for like 3 hours just as my flight boarded. Then they brought me to the plane. So I was able to sit with her. So it was such a nice surprise. What last moment.
What is it about your mum that, you know, you're so close? Like, what she's saying to you in the airport? Is she giving you advice or are you just best friends?
I think we're definitely best friends. And I think I'm not technically an only child, but I have sisters. But I grew up alone in the house with my mum and my dad because my sisters were all much older than me. So it always felt like an only child relationship. And I think my mum probably just got me like we got each other. She definitely knows me inside out. And I think it's not really that she gives me any advice. I just love being around her. She's so positive. And yeah, you can just kind of lean on her. I feel, you know, like the closest person to me because I don't have that kind of relationship with my sisters. Like, I'm very close to them, but they feel like aunties nearly just because of them not living in the house growing up. So yeah, I think mum's like my sister and my mum together.
Mm. I have the exact same relationship with my mum. I would definitely try to bring her all the way to my flight with me.
To the gate, like, come on.
And it's so hard when you're leaving your mum and you're going away and you don't know how long you're going to be away for. Like, that's so tough for anybody to kind of cut themselves off from the people who support them every day.
It was so hard. And I think we had one phone call home for 5 minutes once a week. And it got to the point where I almost didn't want the call because it was so upsetting to only have 5 minutes and to not even be able to tell her like where I was or what I was doing. Because the phone calls were like, hi, like, I've just been to South Africa, but I can't tell you. I've just been to Finland, can't tell you. You know, like, I couldn't say anything about what was going on. And yeah, it was actually harder to just have 5 minutes with her timed, you know, and then hang up the phone. Like, that would make me feel really like I wanted like an hour, you know. So it was really much harder than I thought it would be, actually, to not have constant contact with her.
I'll get back to that conversation in just a minute. But first, I wanted to give you an update on the benefits I'm seeing from using my Fitbit Versa 2. Fitbit allows you to get to know yourself better, to understand your health with data and insights that are unique to you. As I always say, knowledge is power, and Fitbit provides data about your health and well-being to help empower and support you in leading a balanced and healthy lifestyle. I love being able to track my sleep, keep an eye on my resting heart rate over time, as well as capture key stats from my workouts. I'm so happy to have Fitbit on board as it helps keep me focused and on track with my goals and training. Now, back to the conversation. And do they kind of take your phones off you so you remain focused on what you're doing there?
Totally. And you can see why it definitely is distracting. So you have your phone call on the down day, the day where nothing happens. And some of the other girls had children, so they would get an extra phone call. But it got to the point where they didn't want the extra call because it was so distracting and upsetting nearly to kind of leave the bubble for a minute, 5 minutes, and then come back. Like, you just felt upset. And yeah, it was much easier. It sounds crazy, like, take my phone, no contact, but it's actually much easier to stay focused because you can't tell them what you're doing anyway. So there's no real conversation.
I've watched The Apprentice for years, and I think some people come across badly in the edit. Like, was there a part of you that was worried, or you seem to have confidence in yourself? So did you feel like, you know, I'll just be myself and I'll be fine?
That's what I thought. And I really felt like, well, I'll never be that person who looks like a backstabber or mean, because it just isn't who I am. So I'm not going to drift that way. But I definitely felt like, okay, there are certain scenarios where you're trying to find a rigger jigger in Oxford. Like, I already felt like an idiot reading the word going, I have no idea what this is. And I'm going to look like an idiot now. So there are those moments where you think, oh, no matter what I do, I'm going to come across like an absolute knob here. And do you know, I think the only way to take it on is to be able to laugh at yourself. If you're too serious, then you'll look worse. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you don't know how they're going to edit. And sometimes in the middle of filming, you're thinking, oh, they're going to use that, aren't they? You know, you just know, like, and you're thinking, oh. And there were times where I watched it back going, I look like a total idiot here. And there were times where I watched it back as well and thought, you know, that is the way it happened. So like, I don't feel like the edit was unfair to anybody. I think everybody on my series is who they came across as, genuinely. They may not like who that person is, but I worked and lived with all of them, and that is who they are. So yeah, from that perspective, I think it was fair. But yeah, you don't know. Like, there's a constant fear that, you know, I have a consumer facing business. And sometimes there were times where somebody might have been wrong in my group and I had to blame them. And I'm like, you know, it was all our fault, really. And I genuinely felt that. And I knew that wasn't going to make the edit because they don't like that. But I was not going to be a person who ganged up on anyone just for TV, because people buy my product and they buy into me, a part of me at that stage. So it's not going to be, I'm not going to put on a show and risk potentially ruining my reputation like that.
So I thought you came across so well.
Oh, thank you.
And do you kind of leave the issues that you have with each other in the boardroom? And then what's the, like, do you get to switch off in that house, or is it just all go, go, go?
Like, you do. Some people didn't get on, and you know what? You nearly respect people for continuing not getting on in the house, because it is difficult to be fake at the same time. So yeah, there were kind of groups of people that didn't really connect with the main group. And, you know, we'd all be watching Netflix on the down day, or Love Island last year, which was fun. But yeah, it's hard because I was sharing a room with Lottie, and definitely people had massive friction with her. And yeah, it did boil over, because if she was mean to my friend, you know, Karina, because Karina worked with her a lot and I was really close to Karina. Yeah, I felt a bit like, do you know what? This is difficult to be around you. So you would kind of distance yourself from the negativity to try and keep your head in the game. But yeah, I mean, it wasn't the easiest to live with her. But overall, living with everybody else was like a dream.
Wow. And when you went into the boardroom, you seemed, you know, quite confident. And I think if Lord Sugar was grilling me, I'd start crying or something. Yeah. Like, is it as intimidating as it looks on TV?
I feel like it's more intimidating than it looks. Really? Because when you leave the house in the morning for boardroom, they ask you not to speak to each other. And I respect the reason. They don't want you coming up with plans or strategies in the boardroom. You know, they want whoever has to bring you back, whoever the PM is, if they've lost, to be able to have a clear decision without people influencing it. So I understand. But it builds for massive tension. You haven't spoken to anyone in 4 hours. You're sitting about outside waiting to go into the boardroom. The camera's getting all the angles because it's TV. And you're just sitting there, like, you're like, I have not said one word. The first time I'm going to speak is when Lord Sugar says something to me. Like, I hope my voice doesn't squeak. Like, it's just massive tension and stress. Like, I can't even tell you how like, most of us didn't eat for the whole day because we were so stressed. Yeah, it's way more stressful than it looks. And sometimes I did want to cry when he just spoke to me. Like, I did, genuinely. It's like, I'm even like panicked thinking about it.
Because he does come across as really tough, but actually he has a really soft side as well, doesn't he?
He does. And he's fair. You know, nothing he says is unfair. I mean, obviously he challenged me a lot on not being outspoken. And I did feel that was a bit unfair. But on reflection, I understand, like, he only sees you in the boardroom. You know, obviously people report back to him, Claude and Karen. But this is when he sees you. And if you don't speak, like, he doesn't hear from you. So you might as well be a mute on the whole task and not be involved if you're not saying it there and then. So it took me a few weeks to get used to that. And you know, I think probably never having a job, a real corporate job in an office, people are always telling their boss how good they are and what they've done, you know, to get promotions, to get brownie points, whatever, to like make sure that he gets off their back, whatever it might be. So it was a similar scenario to that. Like, you do have to say what you've done or else you'll go unnoticed.
And so you came third. Did you feel disappointed when you didn't get into the final?
As soon as it was us three, I felt satisfied at where I came, whatever happened then. So we were sent out and we had a few minutes to ourselves before Lord Sugar made his decision. And at that stage, I was like, two amazing girls beside me, both have businesses, both in profit, both in completely different sectors to me. Incomparable, in my opinion. Like, you want a bakery, do you want a recruitment company, do you want a beauty brand? Like, how can you compare them? And I felt like whatever happens here, it's his preference and I totally respect his decision. If there were other people there who didn't have a business or who I felt maybe didn't deserve to be there, I might have felt differently. But at that stage, I was so thrilled to have got that far and to be, you know, recognized. It was a really nice feeling after all I'd gone through with the products and my old investor in Dragon's Den. Yeah, it really felt like, wow, out of all these people that applied, out of all the people in the contestants, I'm here.
It was incredible. And then, So when you left then, could you ring home and say that you came third?
So they give you like a little cooling off period. And I was allowed one call to my mum because they don't want you like hopping on social media. Like you've been off it for months. Mm-hmm. So I had to stay in London for a couple of days because we had to go back to film the final. So I was never really out as such, but I did ring my mum and I told her. And yeah, she was thrilled for me. Like I never really got upset that I didn't make the final. I don't know why. I was so happy for the girls as well. I think we all deserve to be there and whatever happened next. And I was kind of happy not to be up against Karina because she was such a good friend of mine. So,
and in that second last episode, you got to mention the name of your business.
Yes.
Which is probably a little bit why you felt satisfied because, I mean, if you had a went in week 4 or 5 or 6, people maybe never would have heard about your business. So you got, you know, your message across, which was great. And like when that episode went out, did you notice a difference in kind of attention on you?
Yes. I think it was, well, I was in London when that came out. So yeah, my phone completely exploded. I think at one stage we had like 70,000 people on the website.
Around that time.
Yeah, because I'd already seen the episode because we filmed You're Fired. So I wasn't really watching it. I was like watching social media and watching my laptop for the first time, like not actually watching the show. And yeah, the attention was incredible. And I think I was so lucky if I wasn't going to win to have gone when I did, because the BBC have really strict rules around advertising. So none of the finalists ever had their brands mentioned because of the interest.
I noticed that.
So that was very interesting. And I thought, okay, and what they picked up on, you know, I felt like was fair. There's another brand that has a cotton bud. It's not part of my range anymore anyway. You know, that's kind of how I felt. So I felt like, okay, I came out looking okay. People were like offended I didn't make the final, which is always nice. You don't want people to think, okay, you got to the final and you didn't win, that's fine. But people were like, I can't believe you didn't get to the final. So the response was so like positive that I just thought it couldn't have gone any better, genuinely.
Wow. And how many people watch these episodes?
So it's like 10 million a night every Wednesday in the UK. Like it's hard to even grasp actually how many people watch it, to be honest.
It's so big over there. And is there a part of you now that's tempted to move over?
I think with Brexit, probably not, just purely because it's great to stay in Europe. But I'm there a lot. Like I wouldn't say no to having an office there. I think I have a lot of opportunities. A lot of investors are looking at my business now. It's kind of at that stage. And most of them are based in the UK. There's two in Ireland. So if I had to relocate for business purposes, Monday to Friday, I would. But I don't know if I'd like to live there full time. I think, yeah, I'm a home bird.
You launched your dry shampoo sheets. Was that the day after that episode?
The day of. Because day Claude of. Went for me and was like, you only have 2 products, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh my God, Claude, like I have more coming. So I thought, you know what? This episode, I'm going to launch a 3rd product, like, whatever it takes, I'm going to. So yeah, eco-friendly, biodegradable dry shampoo sheets. Thrilled with the product. So delighted I could get it out for Christmas and for that episode. So we sold out on first launch. It's back now, thank God.
So what do? Rub the sheet onto your hair?
So the concept is like blotting paper for your face, except one side of the sheet is coated in rice powder. So it's not coloured like your typical white or grey dry shampoo that leaves your hair looking, you know, toned in a different shade. It literally absorbs all of it into the sheet and leaves behind the rice powder. So it's great for your hairline after the gym, if you've got makeup or moisturizer in your hair. So handy for makeup artists too. It's just really easy on the go.
And you're going into Boots with that product, or are you in already?
So we're launching into Boots UK. So ideally we'd have been in for January, but like everything, it takes forever. But yeah, hopefully we'll be launched in by spring. That's my goal. Wow. With all the products.
Oh my God. So what's that like, just knowing that you're going to be in Boots in the UK?
It's mad. But like everything, it's like, so I had the meeting and they listed it. Now we're in that process of getting it on the shelf. Until it's on the shelf, nothing's real for me. So,
and was that because of The Apprentice?
Yeah, so I contacted them. Well, Eyecatcher had launched into Boots just around the time the legislation came in banning it. So I knew that there was an appetite there. I had contacts, I had the buyers that I knew. But of course, a door opener, hi, I'm on The Apprentice. Like, you don't get much better than that. And of course, it's in their interest to capitalize on the promotion and the interest there as well. So yeah, I have no doubt it made the meeting a lot easier. It was a lot more exciting. And of course, they've been following my journey as well. So
wow, that's just priceless, isn't it? The opportunity that The Apprentice has given you, like, it was such a risk worth taking.
Absolutely. And you know, it's definitely, looking for my business partner now is my number one goal for this quarter. And it's only through The Apprentice that I have a choice. It's mad to even think about it. Like, people want to invest in me and I can choose. And yeah, it's just surreal, really, that I've managed to come out of it good and business is better and yeah, make it into losing a positive.
So life is different then from before it and after it.
100%. And when I'm in the UK, I was saying to you, it's mad. People recognize you there. It's so surreal. I can't cope with that. I'm kind of glad I'm here because people don't really do it as much here. Like, we let Beyonce walk down Grafton Street, for God's sake. So nobody's stopping me. But on nights out, sometimes we go, oh, like, you know, that's it. But
especially when you're with Ryan Mark, because he was such a character on it. Oh, like, the two of you guys seem like you're great mates.
Yeah, we got on really well. I think we're both we both had some laugh on The Apprentice together. Like, he just makes me laugh so much. And so yeah, we get on extremely well. He's a really, really nice guy. He might be eating his McDonald's with a knife and fork, but he's sweet, extremely sweet.
Tell us about now speaking in front of 500 people, which you did just last week. How do you, like, because I suppose people are like, you're on The Apprentice, like, that's easy for you. But you'd said that it's not.
No, it's really not. I think TV is one thing. Like, there might be cameras and that never really bothered me. I don't know why. But a room full of 500 people, faces, eyes, questions, you know, it's really unpredictable. And I did, I actually ended up making my presentation about imposter syndrome. Because truly, when I was asked to do it, I felt like, me? You want me to stand up and tell people how to run a business? Here I am begging Lord Sugar to invest in me, like, and I didn't win, you know, like, what am I going to say? But actually, I looked at my story and I thought, there's a lot here that people could take from it, like the mistakes, you know, the issues. We had 60,000 units arrive with no barcode, like, for God's sake, you know, labeling those, having a product discontinued, losing an investor, you know, all of those things I've learned from. And where I feel comfortable is in the beauty space, making my products, you know, creating them. But where I'm not comfortable is standing on a stage or talking to investors or in business, in banking, in accounting. And so that was kind of the angle I took. And I think a lot of people related to that. And so it ended up being like one of the best things I ever did. It made me feel so confident and just delighted that I did it, actually.
Because you've learned so many lessons over the last, you know, 10 years in the industry. And, you know, if there's a girl, young girls listening to this podcast and they want to go down that route, like, what do you say to young people?
What I'd say to my younger self would be, get as much experience as you can, because the more experience you have going into anything, the better it's going to be. You know, I think about myself in business class going, who is going to write out their profit and loss accounts like this? You know, nobody. Actually, it's very valuable. I wish I'd paid more attention. But I think anyone who's looking at running their own business, it's nothing else feels like this. You know, you're not going to get this satisfaction from a job. So do it. You know, it's worth the risk. It's thoroughly enjoyable. It's extremely stressful. But I love that. I love the fast pacedness. And I think the more experience that you have going into that, the more smooth your journey is going to be. So yeah, I mean, I wanted to drop out of school in fourth year and mum was like, no. And obviously that was an amazing thing. I did not need to drop out of school to run a business. The opposite, in fact. And so yeah, the most experience you can get in the industry you're going into will just make it smooth, basically.
So what's the ultimate dream?
The ultimate dream is America, I think, you know, purely because I love their beauty offering there. There's Sephora, there's Ulta. Like, my product, I feel, belongs on their shelves. So if I could reach that, that would just be, oh my God, massive milestone, the ultimate milestone.
Wow, you're so determined. I've no doubt that it's going to happen for you. Thank you so much for coming on my podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Good Glow podcast with thanks to Fitbit. If you're enjoying this podcast, please hit the subscribe button and leave a review. For more on my story, you can follow me on Instagram at georgie.crawford.